Hey, Paul, how you doing? Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, great. Thank you.
Thanks for being here. I think this is going to be a really important and informative episode. As you know, this is the Paleo Policy Podcast, and a big component of that is the policy portion. So hopefully to those listening, I'll try to sprinkle in the dinosaurs where I can, but I think the focus is to provide the basics of this study, how this type of study is, this type of work is performed, and what are the outcomes of public policy and engagement in public policy. So how about we start with just, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself, what you're currently working on at the moment, and what encouraged you to pursue the study of public policy in the first place.
Well, in terms of you know, a first interest in public policy, it I think it came from I studied politics as an undergraduate, so policymaking was the most interesting part of that for me, and it was very much British politics I was interested in. So. Mm-hmm. So believe it or not, I mean, it was the thing I found most useful then was to read Yes Minister, which is a comedy about British politics. And the thing I liked about it was it presented this contrast between the type of politics we see on TV, where it's, you know, elected ministers in charge, and the type of politics or policymaking you see behind closed doors or out of the public spotlight, which is very different, to the extent that I would say the academic description of policymaking is in very strong contrast with popular notions of policymaking. So that's interesting for me, trying to explain the difference and just accept that most people will not see policymaking in the same way that academics will.
And that was like an interest of yours when you were an undergraduate, or was that something that encouraged you or inspired you to pursue this field before you started your undergraduate work?
Yeah, it's the thing I found most interesting as an undergraduate. And to be honest, I didn't find many things interesting, so I kind of hung on to that. But also, to be honest, I only really stuck with politics because I got good grades. You know, I wasn't particularly fascinated. I mean, I've researched it for so long now that, you know, I'm very invested, and I find particular things fascinating. But you know, it wasn't like a lifelong passion or anything like that.
And what are you currently, where do you find yourself today? Tell us a little bit about the present moment you find yourself in, at least, you know, professionally and academically, of course.
Yeah, so like anyone else, I think everything is kind of, what's the word, conditioned by COVID. And so I'm working at home, and I have been since March. I'm relatively well off in that sense because I live somewhere where it was really inconvenient to get to work or to travel for conferences because it's sort of semi-rural. But, you know, now that we are where we are, it's flipped. You know, so I'm sort of almost in the middle of nowhere, you know, which is very handy if you know the most important.
If you're trying to avoid
So to give you a sense of it, I recently spoke with a guy that I see on the dog walk, and we were complaining that you could sometimes see 20 people on the same day, whereas sometimes you can see none. You know, so that's a sense of the scale we have.
Yeah, you know, that reminds me of just, you know, those random stories that you remember and you don't know really why you remember them. But I remember a history teacher of mine, I think it was a 7th or 8th grade, told me, was basically just kind of comparing different sizes of the American population at different times. And I think he had said that he had read somewhere that the townspeople and early colonial America knew that things were getting crowded when you could see the smoke from someone else's home within the fort that you lived in, something like that, just to kind of show how much things have changed. You know, we're so densely populated, or at least, you know, much of the of Earth's population are these, you know, dense metropolitan centers. And when you don't have those contacts, in a populated place like that, it kind of throws you off. But if the opposite could be true, you could be in a place where there aren't many people and you love that, And then you start seeing a few more people and you're like, maybe it's time to go. But I think it's a different situation that you're talking about, because obviously we're in the middle of a pandemic. And so social distancing is important and vital. As I was researching for this episode, I saw that you are currently involved in research assessing the UK's COVID-19 response. How has that been going? And what was the purpose of that analysis?
So, I mean, that mostly began as a sort of obsession in relation to the thing I'm experiencing, you know. So I was interested in, I think the UK shares with the US, I think, a reputation that it didn't deal with COVID very well. With the UK, that was particularly true at the beginning. So, the claim is that it locked down too slowly, you know, in relation to sort of poor information on rates of transmission. So I was interested in the extent to which you could identify poor choices that caused poor outcomes, or the extent to which the people making those choices were not in particular control. You know, so I think that's a wider theme of the academic study of UK politics or public policy in general, is that there's an image that a small group of people are in charge of the process, and if they want to do something, they can. So therefore, the explanation for inaction or failure is that they made poor choices. Whereas I'm interested in the extent to which anyone in charge would have made similar choices, you know, because they had poor information and because they had a much less control over policy outcomes than people would expect.
So,
a particular part of that is this idea or statement by ministers that they were very strongly guided by science, you know, or scientists. And that's quite, it was an uncommonly high emphasis they made on their reliance on scientists. And it was something that was interested in trying to track. And, you know, in a nutshell, if you compare the minutes of their main science advice committee and UK government action, they're pretty close. You know, they're fairly consistent.
And this was something that you did personally or on behalf of the university that you're with?
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose everything I do is
collaboration with others.
Yeah, so I'm now collaborating with others on sort of trying to scale up the sort of research we do. But that began, like a lot of projects, that began as a sort of strong personal interest.
I see. And you're currently at the University of Stirling, correct?
Yeah, so normally people aren't quite sure where Stirling is. So in fact, if I'm speaking to people in the US, to be honest, I would ask them if they've seen the film Braveheart.
And
and if they have, that's where it is. You know, that was
I see. Right.
That's where it took place. So you can sort of see because it's about William Wallace, and you can sort of see the Wallace Monument from my office.
At least I kind of knew where it's at because I was doing research. But yeah, I could see a lot of people not being able to pin it without that assistance. So let's start with the basics. I guess we could start with, what is public policy? Because when I thought about, you know, producing this podcast, I was studying global public policy at Suffolk University. I was interested in the way that communities and networks get together and move policy forward. But I guess before we get to that, you know, part of the process, what is public policy, and is there a central definition of that?
Okay, so usually if I'm teaching public policy, then I'll say that you can come up with a definition, but it's really just to spark discussion. It's not going to give you a sort of satisfying definition the way you would in a dictionary. So the one I like, you know, for those purposes is, what do I call it? The sum total of government action from signals of intent to the final outcome. So the benefit there is that it kind of prompts more questions about policymaking. So the first one is, you know, what does government action really mean? You know, does it include what policymakers say they will do is what they actually do? Because often, you know, policy is a sort of succession of unfulfilled promises that They don't really seem like policy. The second is, if you're talking about intent and outcomes, you know, does it include the effects of a decision as well as the decision itself? You know, so if you look at policy outcomes, they often don't resemble initial policy statements. The third is, you know, a question like, what is the government? Because it's often difficult to identify boundaries, and or sometimes people, when they talk about the government, they mean elected policymakers. But really, most you know, academic studies of government suggest that there are, you know, that most of the actors are unelected policymakers, so they carry out policy without being, you know, formally responsible. And then the final thing is that if you have a definition of policy which is about action, it ignores inaction. And often public policy includes what policymakers decide not to do. You know, so a lot of policy is about power, and it's often the power to close off action rather than actually make it happen.
I see. And when we think of public policy, is there a typical or normal process that it goes through? And if so, how would you characterize that process?
Well, I would say there isn't. I mean, for two reasons, I guess. I mean, one is that each country's political system entertains different processes, you know, so it's hard to identify a single one that would capture all that. The second thing is that people do try to provide, you know, sort of kind of abstract model that covers all policy processes. But I would treat it as a bit like an ideal type, you know, something to compare with real-world policymaking. So the most popular version of that, I think, is often called the policy cycle, in which you break policymaking down into a series of stages, you know, define a problem, identify solutions, legitimize a choice, you know, implement, evaluate, and so on. I think that if you go into the kind of the real minutiae of policy studies, then I think a lot of this came from some confusion between what people might like to happen in policymaking and the study of what actually happens. So I think if you were to train as a policy analyst, you would see policy processes in terms of a cycle, because you're identifying the requirements you have. You know, you need to identify or define a problem of your client and then give them some recommendations on what's feasible and, you know, encourage them to implement in a particular way. You know, so I think kind of simple models are really about what people would like, or, you know, what they, you know, something to do with their training, rather than the study of policymaking, which really tends to identify complexity and mess and indeterminate outcomes and so on.
And how does the nature of, you know, our interconnectedness with the rest of the world, globalization, maybe even post-globalization, how does that influence the process on a local level or on like a regional level? Because I think we, you know, we clearly are seeing not necessarily the risks to interconnectedness, but, you know, certainly there are risks that we have to assess. And obviously with time, we learn more and more how to deal with issues, whether it's, you know, COVID-19 or environmental issues. How is that the increasing interconnectedness influencing that process, if at all?
Yeah, so it's increasingly common to talk about policy problems that transcend national boundaries. So a lot of, you know, the biggest, most urgent or pressing problems are global, and so they require an international response. So I mean, the most obvious ones are, you know, global public health and climate change and such like, where a government can be, you know, can be very effective within its own jurisdiction, but that doesn't really guarantee, you know, outcomes to, you know, to reflect that competence. So I think there are a couple of things that make that tricky with public policy studies. You know, the first is the tradition has been to study country level or fairly national processes, particularly in the US. You know, the US tends to be the standard and their textbooks and public policy that really just describe the US system. So it's not a kind of well-trodden field of study. I mean, the second is partly because it's more difficult to identify the same kind of authoritative policymaking bodies at a global level. You know, most of the, if we talk about, you know, the centralization of power, it's mostly within governments of a particular country, and they're more important than sort of international organizations.
Yeah, that was one of the debates that continued to crop up in my graduate studies was, you know, what is, you know, where does the nature of change come from? Does it come from a centralized source, or does it come from this, you know, either coalitions of networks or these non-governmental entities, whether they be, you know, non-state actors or multinational corporations or, you know, nonprofits and whatnot. And I think that's what, you know, encouraged me to study this particular field, because it just had a diversity of really just nodes that you could examine and see what kind of effects they have. And so I guess, you know, this is certainly a question that could fill an entire episode, but, you know, does the multiplicity of these actors mean that power is decentralizing?
In one sense. So I think the reference point would be the idea that there is in any country a central government where there's a concentration of power. And certainly in that context, a lot of policy studies focus on the diffusion or decentralization of power in two different ways. You know, one is the choice to decentralize. So in the US, you have a constitution that guarantees certain rights for different bodies or divides powers between certain functions. And, you know, in somewhere like the UK, they made a choice, at least until recently, to, you know, share power with the European Union and devolve to Scottish and other governments and local government. So that was a choice. But really, a lot of the study of policy is about the necessity of fragmentation, you know, where it's a kind of go on.
Well, repeat that again, sorry.
So the second aspect is more like something you might call fragmentation, you know, which is there are limits to central government power. They have a limited ability to process information and a limited ability to manage all the issues for which they are ostensibly responsible. So they pay attention to a small proportion of all issues, and they delegate responsibility for most of them. And that's where a lot of the power for other bodies comes in that, you know, central governments are not paying attention or are not taking responsibility for issues. So lots of other bodies sort of fill in the space.
I see. And, you know, one of the phrases that kept coming up during the research that I was performing is this idea of the advocacy coalition framework, which I believe is one of the ways that public, you know, people who analyze public policy describe, you know, it kind of sounds like it's this idea that there are networks that either compete with one another or collaborate with one another to promote or pursue a public policy goal. And I think, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, one of the examples that I think of that might relate to dinosaurs and public policy is the Audubon Society. Are you familiar?
No.
So Audubon Society is essentially an environmental advocacy group that has been pursuing environmental reforms in an effort to save bird populations around the world. And, you know, that birds are the living descendants of dinosaurs. And so maybe it's kind of a stretch to say that maybe this is an example of which, but I guess my question would be, what sort of role do groups like this with groups of people that have the same intention, same purpose, how are they able to affect policy and how do they go about doing that?
Okay, so there's probably, I should give you a little bit of context on that. So the
Sure, yes, please.
Yeah, so the Advocacy Coalition framework, I think, began as a study of places like Lake Tahoe. You know, it was about the management of land and water. And what they were observing was high levels of conflict between basically two different coalitions. You know, one wanted to develop it for, you know, economic reasons, and the other wanted to keep it as far as possible unspoiled for environmental reasons. So, you know, you could, it's often used to study those kinds of conflicts based on very strongly held beliefs. You know, so the kind of foundation would be that people go into politics and policymaking to turn their beliefs into policy. And to do so, they form coalitions with people who share their beliefs. And I think the benefit of that kind of discussion is that these coalitions or, you know, actors with the same belief, they transcend different jurisdictions, you know. So they can be, you can form a coalition with people at different levels of government or with people who are inside or outside of government. So they sort of gain influence through their participation, but also the extent to which they can form alliances with people who share their beliefs.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, one of the, you bring up Lake Tahoe, it kind of reminds me of, you know, there's a dispute in the States at the moment, at least between various groups. In the state of Utah has one of the highest rates of federally managed lands in the U.S. There are more national parks and national monuments out west than there are in the east. I think last time I saw, sometime 2015, 2016, 63.1%, I believe, of Utah's land was federally regulated. And in an area, and in a country where you have the concept of federalism and this separation between the central and you know, state governments, there's disputes as to, you know, executive actions taken in the past by previous administrations to preserve certain plots of land. Two of them, the two that are in question right now, and this is one of the things that kind of encouraged me to kind of look at paleontology from a public policy lens, is the decision by the Trump administration to reduce the size of two national monuments in Utah, Bear's Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante. And when you dig into, you know, who are the parties and what side they're on, they have their own similar interests. There are those on one side that believe that the state of Utah should have more, you know, jurisdiction of these lands and determine what to do with them, because there happen to be a lot of natural resources in that area. But there are, you know, small business owners, paleontologists, and environmentalists who want to keep that land as undisturbed as possible and believe that it holds significance not only for the moment but for generations to come. And so there's, it's currently being debated in the legal system, and there probably won't be any traction on it until after the election. And I guess that that kind of brings me to my next question, which is, and I kind of take this from your blog, what sort of role does storytelling have in this process? Because ultimately you're trying to convince people to either join you, perform an action, or to abstain from performing a certain action. And I think storytelling is how you do that, but exactly how does that manifest itself in this process?
Well, there is a connection to studies of our advocacy coalitions to some extent. You know, so there's the narrative policy framework to sort of try and measure the impact of stories. I mean, there are two closely related concepts here. One is framing, which is essentially an act, an exercise of power to draw attention to a particular way to define or understand a policy problem. Whereas your narrative or storytelling is a bit wider. It includes a story with, you know, context, but also a moral of a moral to our take-home message, and, you know, particular characters such as heroes or villains and that sort of thing. So, but I think the basic idea is that people share information via story. You know, they turn a very complex world that's you know, unmanageable for people into something far simpler that people can understand. And and so an effective narrative or narrator, appeals to an audience's emotions and way of seeing the world. And if they can do that, then they can motivate people to act. So I think often narratives are there, or at least the most impactful narratives are ones which appeal to an audience that already holds certain beliefs, but helps motivate them to do something about it. You know, so within that advocacy coalition framework, you know, people would tell stories to rally their allies, you know, to motivate people to join their cause, rather than, you know, this idea that you can sort of change hearts and minds with stories. I think most of the evidence is that the impact is on people who are already predisposed to accept them in the first place.
As opposed to, now, is that separate from the idea of coalition building? Because I remember that being part of part of this process as well. But I don't know if now I'm wondering, is coalition building within a group of people who hold the same beliefs, or is it some people outside of that and you're trying to widen the tent, so to speak?
Yeah, so often people will talk about, to some extent, you know, nascent coalitions or potential coalitions. And if so, the role of narrative is to identify and motivate as many relevant people as possible. But that's not the, I suppose the point would be, that's not the only way to build a coalition. The other is to provide resources. Yes, you know, so a lot of coalitions are sort of built up with, for example, the material resources or authority from particular organizations, you know, rather than this idea that there's someone, the great orator bringing together a whole bunch of people.
Mm-hmm. I guess one of the reason why I bring up this question, because I was, as I was researching, I came across a video of yours that you might be familiar with. I think it's titled, "Does Policy Analysis Produce Better Advice?" And you were in the video, if you remember, you were offering advice to scientists involved in public policy. Can you speak a little to that and kind of their importance when it comes to public policy? Because, I was speaking with someone, Dr. Paul Murphy, on Monday about paleo mitigation. And one of the things that he had brought up was, the kind of work that the paleontologists are doing to provide mitigation policies. Mitigation is, preserving as much as possible the scientific, non-renewable resources, they call it, that they find on construction sites and development site and stuff like that. They produced a mitigation report or a best practices guide that ultimately, hopefully, is implemented on a much broader scale, is, taken on by, bureaucracies, agencies like the Bureau of Land Management or the National Park Service, or even down to like the county local level. Can you speak to A, just kind of the importance of actors like this, especially within the field of paleontology? Paleontologists and preparers are always the first one to be consulted when it comes to issues like this. And also, how, I guess the other question would be, how could you make their work more effective to actually change policy?
Okay. So, for a while, from 2016, I did quite a lot of talks to people outside of, policy process studies, and the most popular question that we came up with for the talk was along the lines of, why don't policymakers listen to my evidence or do anything about it? Uh-huh. And I think the context was, researchers would have this idea, I've done this excellent research, it's high quality, it's been published after peer review, and, there's like an agreement that this is the sort of state of the art in this field. And yet there's a very large gap between that and policy action. And, so usually people express their frustrations about this and often blame politics as some sort of problem, as a sort of pathological, or blame policymakers for not being intelligent enough or having other reasons not to pay attention. So usually that's the context. And I would come at it from a very different perspective in which, to be honest, for most of my career, it's been unusual to study concepts like evidence or evidence-informed policymaking. You know, it doesn't often occur to researchers of policy as much as scientists who are dissatisfied with policymaking. So usually I would sort of break down an explanation into sort of three main points. The first is that policymakers don't understand evidence and research in the same way as researchers. You know, they don't have the same sense that there is a sort of a gold standard that must be listened to. They're much more eclectic, and one of their standards is policy relevance rather than, you know, research quality. And there are many policymakers in the system, you know, so it's unlikely that there would be any kind of inevitable link between producing research and anyone wanting to pay attention to it. And the second explanation would be that, so this relates to this idea of what knowledge processes look like. So I think often in research, people think of a metaphor of filling a gap or adding to a sort of a body of knowledge. Yeah. And I think it's more useful in politics to think of the opposite, to think of almost everyone trying to ignore as much evidence as possible so they can make choices. And I think if you get into that mindset, then you would ask yourself, why would anyone pay attention to this research? You know, what's going to motivate them to do it? And usually that relates to, you know, science communication, which talks mostly about, you know, keeping things concise, you know, turn your 500-page report into one page and that sort of thing.
Three bullet points max.
Yeah, that sort of thing. But I think the sort of the other element of that is framing that research to help it appeal to a particular audience. You know, so that is trying to work out who your audience is, what their beliefs are, and how your research would help them fulfill certain policy goals. And you know, it's usually, I would say, seen as more realistic than expecting this kind of new killer piece of research to just change everyone's opinions on the world. And then the third explanation would be that, you know, the policy process is complex and it's very difficult to know how it works. Therefore, it's difficult to know how researchers would fit in. You know, so even people who study policymaking for their whole careers, I think would struggle to work out who they should speak to and where the action is in any particular case without putting in a lot of initial research on policymaking. So if your full-time job is to produce scientific research, I would normally expect a kind of lack of knowledge or impact, you know, just because it's so difficult to know, you know, how to act and who to speak to.
So this just a hypothetical. What do you think would be a more effective tactic for, let's hypothetically, you know, there's a climatologist performing, or a paleoclimatologist performing some sort of research in the Antarctic region, taking out ice cores and trying to measure, you know, temperature fluctuations over an extended period of time. What would be more effective tactically for that researcher when it comes to, let's say he has a policy prescription in his analysis? Would it be more effective to try to translate that to policymakers or to groups or advocacy coalitions or nonprofit groups or the broader society in general?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I mean, my gut would say that if someone's job is to do scientific research and it's not to be engaged in politics and policymaking, I would think their best bet would be to work with someone whose job is to influence policy. You know, it's not to go straight to source, but it's to, you know, work as part of a network or a coalition or a not-for-profit that knows how to translate fairly technical information into something that a wider audience would care about. And I think a lot of scientists do that. You know, they work with, you know, so-called knowledge brokerages, or they they find organizations that share their beliefs and you know, rely on them to do something. So I think it is fairly common.
Okay, I see. And kind of just shifting gears to you know, have someone be able to envision what this type of work looks like. What type of work do policy analysts engage in? People who are not, I mean, I guess they could be involved in government as well, but not necessarily those who are making decisions. What type of work does that entail?
Well, I mean, I guess you can anticipate what I'm going to say, which is that it's very difficult now to know what a policy analyst is and what they do and where they are. So there's this sort of excellent series of books by people like Beryl Radden, and they sort of chart a difference between essentially an image of policymaking in the olden days compared to policymaking now. And in the olden days, there was this idea that it was sort of late 1940s, early 50s, and scientists were going to apply scientific methods and principles to policymaking, you know, to solve problems technically. So, you know, for example, there were a lot of economists, you know, employed in sectors like defense, and they were going to rationalize a lot of these processes. But, you know, to cut a long story short, now the image is of lots of different types of analysts with lots of different skills working for lots of different people. So there's no blueprint for how to do it. But if you, you know, if you were to study policy analysis with a textbook, most of them would have, you know, X number of steps, you know, from start to finish. And, you know, the classic five, there are lots of them. It's a bit like, you know, you get those videos, 8-minute abs or 5-minute abs, that sort of thing. You can choose your number, but I think the five step is they identify or define a problem on behalf of a client. They come up with a manageable number of feasible solutions. They then identify the values or other criteria they'll use to compare the value of each solution. Then they predict the outcome of each solution, and then they make a recommendation. Mm-hmm. And so I quite like that kind of breakdown because it just sounds so simple, you know, but essentially they're making a recommendation to one person or organization. And the chances are that person or organization will not have the sole power to act on their recommendations or make sure it happens. You know, so really there are lots of analysts acting increasingly a bit like lobbyists or people who are trying to influence policy because they know that you can't rely on one audience or client. If you want something to happen, you have to sort of engage in different networks or different levels of government.
And so what sort of impact do these analysts have on the policy process? You know, because I have like studied this and intend to like work in this field, and it fascinates me. But, you know, for those who are not familiar, what sort of impact do they have, and who do they have an impact upon?
So the honest answer is I don't know. And it's very difficult to connect, you know, something that an analyst does in a document. You know, normally these are sort of, 10, 20 page documents. It's very difficult to know what effect they have on particular people. There are lots of different kind of models or theories that talk about the role of individuals in policymaking. So, I mean, one of the ones that's quite popular is this idea of policy entrepreneurs. You know, they invest a lot of time getting to know policy processes or form relationships with people so that they know the right time to propose a particular policy solution. You know, so often, you know, Kingdon would talk about a window of opportunity in which there's high attention to a problem. They have a solution that's feasible ready, and you know, policymakers are motivated to act. You know, so you can, under those circumstances, see a role for someone like an analyst who can act at the right time and speak to the right people. But the interesting thing about that kind of approach is how often Kingdon used to talk about those windows opening. And in the case studies he talked about, they were opening every 1 or 2 decades. You know, it wasn't like it wasn't like a window of opportunity for an individual where if you catch them in the right mood that day, something might happen. You know, in a political system, it could be something might happen tomorrow or it might not happen for 20 or 30 years.
And, you know, one of the, this is kind of now down to like a smaller level, but, you know, can you speak to, you know, at least what the perspective is from a student coming in, you know, because when I think of the paleontological community, one of the main nodes of that group, I think, are the students that engage in that type of work and in that type of study. How has policy analysis changed for students now? I mean, you could even go back to before COVID-19, because I'm sure that's going to change a lot of things as well. But how is policy analysis from the student perspective changing?
I mean, probably in terms of if you sort of track the editions of these textbooks, they probably shifted in terms of early textbooks might have focused on you know, intellectual analysis and analytical mm-hmm. techniques like cost-benefit analysis. In fact, I think you can do, you know, modules on how to do a kind of gold standard cost-benefit analysis. I think increasingly those textbooks focus on wider skills such as relationship building and networking and stakeholder analysis and your coalition formation and so on. You know, so you would imagine that it's one thing to produce a document that provides an argument for a policy change, but that most people's energies would be focused on speaking to the right people and, you know, forming alliances and so on.
And, you know, now that obviously we can quantify so much more nowadays than we could in the past, how do people quantify and prove that their analysis is sound in the realm of public policy, whether it's a student or, a professor or an analyst? How do you measure the effectiveness of a policy?
Okay, so in terms of the impact of the policy itself?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, it's very difficult. I mean, I think there's a distinction between forecasting its impact and monitoring. So most policy analysis, I think, is about forecasting, which is it's like an intelligent estimate. Mm-hmm. I mean, monitoring the impact of policy is more straightforward, I guess, if the policy change is relatively simple and can be separated from all other actions. You know, so there are examples. I mean, the one that just sprung to mind was the example of an increased use of bans of smoking in public places. So you can monitor mm-hmm. the levels of compliance with that policy. And in countries like the UK, you know, it's close to 100%. So that's a kind of one way of monitoring success. But really those policies are used to contribute to a reduction in smoking itself. And that's much more difficult to connect, you know, to find a causal link between that individual instrument and a reduction in smoking. You know, because that's caused by maybe another 10 different instruments.
By instruments, do you mean like actual devices that record or like that record this information and track it? What do you mean by that?
Sorry. Yeah, I mean, I suppose, yeah, people use these phrases, either a policy tool or a policy instrument. And it would be, yes, it wouldn't be a musical instrument. It would be a means sure. to an end, you know. So it's,
I see.
For example, you know, an economic incentive or a tax or a regulation on behavior or a voluntary agreement or, you know, a funding for an organization, you know, all of those things would sort of be grouped together and called policy instruments.
Okay. I see. I guess in closing, because I wasn't able to address this in the beginning, can you tell us about the blog that you have? Because I found it incredibly useful when I was a graduate student to be able to explain concepts that I hadn't visited for a while since my undergraduate career. Can you tell us kind of how that got started and what sort of work you do with your blog?
Yeah, so it's funny timing because I got an email this week from someone telling me how difficult it is to navigate and gave me some useful advice on how to simplify it. You know, so I think part of that is explained by the fact that when I started developing the blog, I wasn't entirely sure who my audience would be or how they would find the website. So I envisaged it at first as, you know, largely getting an audience via Twitter. You know, the more followers I got, the more people would be there. But now it's at the stage where most of the traffic is from Google searches, and they're, you know, searching for things like, you know, what's policy and looking for these concepts. Initially I thought that, I think if you teach, you have this frustration that you want your students to do their searches on Google Scholar or something like that.
Mm.
But you know that they're going to do their searches on Google. So,
or Wikipedia.
Yeah. And so I thought, well, what if they did their search for this concept on Google, they would find my website instead. And that would be almost as good. You know, so I wrote these 1,000-word explainers, about, you know, sort of 2 dozen of them now, and they try and summarize. In the beginning, they were summarizing each chapter of the book, you know, so they were on each of these kind of big policy theories or post on power or ideas or that sort of thing. And the idea, if I was being really optimistic, the idea was this would be like a gateway to reading the chapter, and then the chapter would be a gateway to reading the source material. But I'm pretty sure that most students start and end with the blog post. So I think...
Fascinating, yeah.
Yeah, so now that I know that, I know that I have to sort of sum up everything in the knowledge that it's not an introduction. It's a substitution.
I see. And so going forward, if anyone was interested in following up with you, how could they, you know... keep track or like see what you're working on at the moment, other than I guess the blog?
Yeah, you can follow the blog, I think, and it sends you an email when I've done a post. Pretty much anything I've thought I written down is in there somewhere, so that would be the place to go. Yeah, I do get people who the best way to get me is through email, and my email is on the blog. And I do have people who are often doing a PhD or a master's, and they're not sure of something, and they'll get in touch and ask me for, you know, advice on how to inform their research. And almost all of the time, I'm really happy to do so, and we can, you know, set up a conversation with people. So
this is how this got started. So it's totally, I believe you.
Okay, I mean, I think I'm at the stage where it's manageable. It's a bit like, I think the parallel I would give is when we give feedback on exams, at least in the UK, we say you have the right for oral feedback, and we can manage it because almost no one actually asks for it. So,
everyone's trying to get home. Yeah.
So my general offer is manageable because not many people actually get in. You'd be surprised. I think, you know, very few people actually take up that kind of offer.
Yeah, and, you know, sometimes you don't know if you'll get a response back, but it's good to know that we'll hear back from you at some point.
Yeah, I hope so.
Awesome. Well, thank you for your time today, sir. This was a great discussion.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thank you. Have a good one.
You too.